So, welcome everyone to compiler construction today. So, last time we had an excursion into type checking and deciding type equality and subtyping for more than just literal name comparison. And we were stuck right in the middle of a few examples of checking for subtype relation. So there were two other examples still to go. So this is, for example, the second example out there. Here we compare two types S2 and S1 for subtyping. So S2 is supposed to be the subtype of S1. So in order to do so, we explore all the different accessors to the supertype S1. This would be A, B, and F. So let's have a look at A and B. And for A and B, we see that this is int for S1 as well as S2. So this is already fulfilled. So let's check for subtyping for the accessor F, which is in both cases a function type. So we have to check whether S2 with parameter R2 is a subtype of S1 with parameter S1. So in order to do so, we have seen that we need to compare for subtyping the return types in covariance. So we have to check for S2 being a subtype of S1. And this is a thing that we don't need to pursue any further, since this is the same subtyping query as the one that we have started with. So instead, we look at the respective types of the parameters, and they are compared contravariantly. So S1 goes there, R2 goes there. And, well, let's continue with that. For that, we have to look at the accessors of the supertype. So this is what R2 is all about. R2 has the accessors A and F, so that's why we have A and F. For A, in both of the candidates, R2 and S1, we have int, so this is already okay. So then remains the question of what accessor F gives us, and this is a function type for R2 resolved to R2 with parameter S2, and in S1 this is another function type of S1 with parameter S1. So by the way, this is a similar query to the one that we have seen right here. It's just the other way around. You might be tempted to say that, well, if A is the if you're in process of showing that A is a subtype of B, encountering a query of whether B is a subtype of A is a bad thing. But bear in mind, we're talking about subtype with a notion of subtype or equal. So there's still the possibility that both types are actually really equal. So it's not this is not a cause for canceling and aborting, but instead we still need to continue exploring these types. So since these are function types, that's already quite nice that they are both function types, but let's go more into detail. So S1 and R2 need to be checked for subtyping in there. And, well, this is a thing that we have seen already over here. So just having something already appearing a little earlier on alone does not help, but it doesn't create any more information to explore these two things because we have already done so earlier on, so we don't need to continue with this one. Instead, let's focus on the parameters. They are compared contravariantly, so S2 goes there and S1 goes there, and well, this turns out to be the same one as this one. So this also doesn't need to be explored any further, and there is no open branches anymore. We didn't encounter any contradiction, so all in all, we can assume that S2 is actually a subtype of S1. And in consequence, we have also shown that S1 is a subtype of R2, by the way. So in one completed exploration tree, if we have queries on the way, we can also assume that each of these subtyping queries that are nodes of this tree are also valid. So that is a thing that you might want to reuse, for example, if you continue with other subtyping queries further on. So in case, for example, this turned out to be something like an exam assignment, you might be interested in checking earlier subtyping trees, whether they already provide you with a little bit of insight into a few of these subtyping queries. Okay, so third example, a little bit different from the one before, but in a similar fashion. We have to, in this case, compare S2 and R1 for subtyping, and well, again, it's always the supertypes accessors that are of interest, so it's R1's accessors instead of S2's, and this is good because S2 has one accessor more than R1, so let's take R1's accessors, and these are A. A leads for both of them to int, so this is already good. Then F provides us with two function signatures, for which, again, we compare the return types covariantly, like this. And this is the same subtyping query as the one from above, so we don't follow there anymore. And, well, let's compare the other one contravariantly. So R2 goes there and R1 goes there. R1 and R2 are so far not present yet, so let's do our usual thing with exploring whatever accessors R2 has. This is A and F. A, in every case, resolves to int, so this is fine. F, again, is a function type. We look it up in R2 and in R1. This gives us R1 with parameter R1 and R2 with parameter S2. So, again, covariantly compare the return types, and this gives us R1, R2, which is the same as above, and contravariantly comparing the parameters, which is S2, R1, which is also the same as before. So, that's it. So this is how you do these kind of subtyping subtyping checks. Good. So what you've seen me do on these slides is that I have omitted a few deductions, particularly the ones where I would resolve the type defs with the actual inlined versions of the types. This is just for matters of presentation. So you would probably, if you would be really verbose, so you would still have these things. But for our purposes, we could just look them up and perform them directly. So a concept like this one is already pretty close to what these object or classes type checks would usually do, with this notion of subtyping being being lifted to structures and not just simple types. And this is already quite close of what objects subtyping would be. Okay, so that is all concerning the type checking. We are now rapidly approaching the final parts of the compiler, particularly the code. Well, it says synthesis, since this is this classical division into analysis and synthesis of a compiler, but you would usually call this kind of phase not the code synthesis, but the code generation phase of a compiler. So this is just, academic. So what you would do in the code generation part is that the code generation is a thing that is done usually on the abstract syntax tree, usually with the help of a few attributes being evaluated in order to obtain things like typing information and information about the collection of local variables for that particular scope and similar things. So the code generation itself then can be seen as a thing that you can boil down to local actions for each of the subtrees of such an abstract syntax tree. So this is particularly also suited to be done in an attribute grammar-like fashion. So what you then do is that you state rules for each of these subtree classes, how to assemble the part of machine code that you want to generate for this particular subtree, if you are given the code that corresponds to the children of your current subtree. And that way you puzzle together the code that is corresponding to that complete subtree that you're looking at that point. And, well, you continue assembling piece by piece until you arrive with the code generation attribute of the root node, which gives you the complete generated program. So in that sense, the code generation is just another code attribute for your attribute grammars in your compiler. And yeah, the code generation itself just is specified as a synthetic property that makes use of a few other attributes that are already given at that point. So what we require in order to come up with such a system is the semantics of the language that we are trying to compile. For our purposes here, we look at a simple procedural language like the C language here, and we need semantics of the actual machine instructions. So, let's have a look at what we can emanate from in a very generic way. And therefore, we have a look at an kind of abstract machine model that we call the register C machine. And this is a machine that doesn't have an actual real architecture behind it. That is a thing that you might see as an inconvenience at first. However, if you are, if you know a few actual machine architectures, you might have also seen a few of the ugly parts of machine architectures already, and we try to spare ourselves with those issues that usually don't involve a lot of intellectual work, but more like inconvenient practical hacks that you have to put into a system. So instead, we do an abstracted version of a machine instruction set that we call the register C machine. So this is a virtual machine, or abstract machine, in the sense that there is no concrete processor around that can actually execute the instructions as you find there. However, it should be very easy to actually come up with an interpreter for such a thing. So this shouldn't add too many layers. It should be pretty easy to implement. And usually you could also continue on in your compiler to generate actual real machine code emanating from this abstract virtual machine. And this is a very common technique that you see in concrete compilers. There's usually some kind of intermediate representations, and in many compiler architectures there is some kind of pseudo assembler that is not particularly machine dependent, that serves as a intermediate format and is there in order to enable a more flexible way of providing different target architectures. So you do kind of general translation in the first part, where you translate into this kind of abstract intermediate machine, and then you have several output modules that then take this already quite low down specified semantics of what you want, and quite easily compiles that into actual real target machine code. So for our purposes, the RCMA is a thing that has at least an interpreter implemented that comes also with a visualization environment. So this can be obtained in some place on our homepage, I think. What are the assumptions that we do for that? Because this is, intended to be for education and for this lecture particularly. So we spare ourselves to implement a lot of the types that are out there, particularly the floating point types. We leave away because they usually don't have a large impact on the control flow in a program, and can in many cases even be delegated to some kind of coprocessor, for example, or to some instruction subset like the SSE or MMX or whatever extension you want to look at. So this is a thing that we consider to be a lot of typing, but not a lot of conceptual things. So we leave them out and just assume that everything that is in there is just integer and just has one integer size and can be considered to be one unit of the memory, and gives us a little bit more convenience of addressing all that. We don't look at instructions to communicate with the operating system. These are things that you can usually add to such language concepts by providing kind of library functions that then perform these communications. If there is some actual real processor support necessary for that, you could insert that in terms of inline code, inline assembly code, all the time. And another quite comfortable thing that we will just assume here is that the RCMA has an unlimited supply of registers. That comes maybe a little bit shocking in the first moment, but it turns out that this isn't too strong of a requirement. You can usually assume that target architectures have different numbers of actual real registers available anyway. So at some point, you would have to have such a conversion to your actual target machine. So there is a phase that needs to break down the registers that you used for compilation to the actual available number of registers anyway. So if we have to do such a phase, well, why bother with some arbitrary limitation anyway? So let's just use an unlimited supply of registers and keep the actual register allocation to the target code generator. So this is the thing. Also, well, you might have heard about a few of these systems, like the Dalvik VM, which was one of the prominent virtual machines, particularly for Android mobile devices, or the LLVM compiler suite, that have kind of similar concepts around. So Dalvik VM and LLVM, for example, both of them have concepts of unlimited supply of registers in that sense, and they are perfectly fine in that sense. So, yeah, what do we need for talking about particular virtual machines? So, well, what we usually need, of course, is what we have already said. We need a set of instructions that we refer to when doing the target code generation. And they usually refer to some kind of hardware that is modified with these instructions. So there's a concept of some virtual hardware, which is usually given as a collection of data structures that represent what we can do on such a machine. And the combination of these data structures usually gives us an idea of the current configuration of the virtual machine. And, well, these data structures are then, of course, during the run of a program, modified by the actual VM instructions. Yeah. So what we also need is some kind of general engine or driver of the program, which is the core interpreter for the for a stream of virtual machine instructions. And this is considered to be part of what we call the runtime system that is there for the actual execution and the modification of the machine configuration. So what typical virtual machines feature, and this might be quite close to what people know from the virtual machines lecture, is usually some way of accessing code. So there's a code store involved, which we can refer to by means of a dedicated memory cell that we, or well, register cell that we call the program counter, that stores the current position that the interpreter considers the actual machine state to be related to. And the other side is usually the data store, and this usually has two notions of access. There's usually some kind of LIFO typed data access to the data store. So we have a stack concept in virtual machines. Therefore, we usually have a dedicated register that we call the stack pointer that that manages the so far allocated space of the stack by pointing to the topmost used cell of the stack. And in case the stack needs to grow, this this register is incremented, and in case that the stack shrinks, this is decremented again. And the rest of the stack, well, in earlier times, just the space that was above the stack. In later times, then some dedicated segments of the store was used for heap objects and could be allocated explicitly with some kind of allocation or memory management system in that sense. Okay, so we mentioned the core driver of such a virtual machine, which would be the main interpreter loop. And the idea of that thing would be to step by step load instructions from the code area and interpret that, and we would use the program counter to specify what the next instruction would be. So what you would usually do in the core loop then would be to obtain the next instruction by querying the code memory at the position of the program counter, and then increment the program counter so that the next time we enter the loop body, the next instruction in terms of, well, just the fall through address would be taken as the follow-up instruction, and then we would continue with an execute function that would then take the encoding of the instruction that we obtained from memory and performs some modification on the system. This is a quite established technique to do it exactly like this, since you might a little bit later on see that we need at some point to come up with an idea of how to implement branching, for example. And branching would mean that you would deviate from your typical fall-through behavior of the code loop to a non-linear continuation of the instruction sequence. And this can be done by the executing function by having a side effect on the actual program counter that would lead to a different address being the continuation address, but the default behavior would be just that the program counter is incremented by one and point to the next instruction then. Okay, so the whole loop is in that sense executed for all eternity until the execution function at some point finds that there is a halt instruction, which would usually then lead to some direct exit of the program that would then give control back to the actual operating system. So the interpretation or execution of the halt instruction would be the one that leaves this loop by somehow terminating the actual virtual machine process. So a little bit more specifically to what we do here for our register C machine and the code generation for that is that we need to a typical thing that we need to provide an approach to is to evaluate expressions in C, for example. So this is a very typical task, and this is usually the place the area where we entered our concepts also in other virtual machine schemes. So The task on hand would be that we are given a particular expression. An expression is a thing like an arithmetic expression, like the one you see here, and come up with an instruction sequence that interprets this expression in a way that it computes the actual value of the expression, so we call that evaluation of the expression, and keeps the value of the expression in a well-known place so that we can reuse it in case that this expression is nested somewhere where we can still refer to this expression. So in that sense, we can nest expressions into each other, and therefore we need some way of keeping the so far evaluated expression around. And well, the question would be how to do that. Well, since we have already said that expressions might be nested, the idea would be to evaluate expressions beginning at sub-expressions and sub-expressions of sub-expressions until we reach some kind of leaf in the tree structure of such an expression, and then for leaves like constants or variables, we would have a simple way of determining the evaluation of such a thing, and with that we would then have the first intermediate evaluation result, which we would for the register C machine keep in some kind of temporary register, and then continue with the evaluation of the parent sub-expression. And since we have the intermediate result already present, we can directly evaluate this sub-expression, continue with the parent until we have step-by-step reached the complete expression. So in order to do so, we need to store the intermediate result in some temporary register in a way that we can find it again. So this is what we're going to see on the slides after that. So apart from this generic part that almost all of the virtual machines that we have feature, we add a new thing, particularly for the register C machine. So these are registers that can be used for well, local variables. So this is the set R lock, and they are particularly consisting registers named like R1, R2, RI, whatever number we might desire. We have an unlimited supply of registers, at least in our virtual machine, and we can use them in a way that suits us. As a second component that comes into the game are the so-called global registers, starting from R0 and going further with R-1, R-2 to some RJ, with J being some kind of negative number. So R with negative index is considered to be a global register. There's absolutely no means for safeguarding that we actually really use these registers with positive indices as local registers only, and the negative and zero registers as global registers only. This is just a thing that we have to remember throughout our code generation. Otherwise, we break things quite badly. So this is just a soft requirement. We, when we provide the code generation scheme, need to keep to these conventions. So it's conventions only. So if we have things like that, how can we continue? So the local registers are things that we consider to have several purposes. One purpose would be to use them for a requirement that we have already set up before, particularly saving intermediate results of expression evaluation. So temporary results are values that go into local registers. Also, a thing that will pop up a little bit later on is the need for representation of local variables of a function. And, well, you probably have quickly seen that local is also a thing that is mentioned directly there. So this is also a use case for the local registers. So local variables of a function also go into local registers. And the thing that is quite well, the thing that we need in order to completely implement the features of the machine, like function calls, means that we need to efficiently store and restore these variables onto the stack in case that we need to reuse these variables, particularly local variables need to go to the stack in case that you call another function, since this other function comes with its own local variables and needs the space in the local variables. So the only way to create space for the new locals would be to store away the old ones on the stack of the machine. Okay, so what then do we do with the global registers? Well, of course, we can always reserve a particular part of the global variables for the we can reserve a particular part of the global registers for the global variables in the program. However, we also need space in the global registers for saving the parameters of a function. So since the local variables usually don't survive when in the local registers when we perform an actual function call, we need some other place to store them too. So this is usually where the global registers come into play. These are temporarily then overwritten by the actual parameters of a function and directly taken on into the local registers of a new function instance, and then used in the fashion that it that is suited for that. Also, the other part where caller and calling communicate with each other is when there is a result of a function communicated, and for that purpose we need some way of storing the result of a function, and this is then also done in the global registers. So, for now, when we do the expression evaluation, what we need to do is we need to find slots for the intermediate values of the expressions that we have evaluated so far. So, as we have seen, this happens in the local registers, so for now we just use local registers. And in order to have some concept so that we don't create a lot of chaos, we introduce some kind of counter variable that tells us how many registers are so far already in use and should not be overwritten with new temporary values. This is this counter I that we use, and this counter has to be interpreted the following way. A register whose index is smaller than this I is conceptually in use, whereas a register with an index that is larger or equal to I is available for storing intermediate values. So with that in mind, we can start thinking about what few instructions should do. So let's start with the simple expressions. These are the ones that are conceptually at the leaves of an expression. So these are the ones that start contributing values for expressions. And the way that we would implement them on our machine would be, for example, if we encounter a particular constant C, we would like to move that C value into a register for the purpose of keeping it as the intermediate value for this sub-expression constant. And in order to do so, we introduce a machine instruction for that, which is usually this load C instruction for our purposes, and we have to give it a particular register with an index in order to save that into. And the other that we might use is, well, we might want to refer to the value of some local variable, for example. In that case, we are interested in transporting the current value of that variable into a space where we will reuse it in order to evaluate the current expression. So we need some way of transferring the value from one register to another, and therefore we introduce another instruction, which is this move between registers. So with that, we move from register RJ to RI, in the sense that we copy its value. With that now, we can start introducing patterns for translating expressions, particularly the expressions for encountering a constant and a variable. And encountering a constant in an expression would lead to loading the constant. Encountering a variable would lead to moving from the register that belongs to the variable in question to the intermediate result register. So how do we know which index we should use for the intermediate register? This is a thing that we have said that we would manage in a used register counter I. And this is transported along the evaluation of a register in an additional parameter over here. So you would for this whole scheme to work, you would start doing code generation for an expression by initializing this I parameter with with the currently first free register index, and this index would be handed down into the code generation functions of each of the sub-expressions until it arrives at the leaves of such expressions, where it is then immediately put to use in order to store the values of constants and variables in there, and will be reused later on. A first example of how this is reused will be seen in there. So here, this is the code generation function for an assignment, and the assignment itself is given the first free register I, and the assignment usually has two parts. There is the part of the variable that the result is assigned to, as well as the expression from the right hand side. So what usually is done is that we call the code generation function of the right hand side with code R of the right hand side expression E with the free variable I, and this will descend down, evaluate everything, and bring back a value. And the question is, where do we find the value? Well, usually the value comes in the register with the index that we have given to this code function, as it does, for example, for the constant. We have communicated the value of the constant in the register that whose index was given to us by the call to the code generation function. So we usually find the evaluated version of the expression in terms of a value in register RI. So we can take the value in RI and store it in register with the index A, and the index A is a thing that we obtain from what we call the environment of the code generation, and this is a thing that has been given to us by the declaration use analysis and the symbol table, where we have analyzed the program for its identifiers used and bound their declarations to those identifiers, and kept a lookup table that we call the environment of the program here, and there we could look up metadata for each of these identifiers, and the ones that we can obtain with this row thing here would be the actual number of the local variable in the collection of local variables, which we can use to index our registers here. And thus, for each name that is known in the or visible in the current scope, we find a different location in terms of a register where to store that. So this is how we obtain the target register where to store our value, and with that we can continue code generation. So for all the other types of expressions that are around, we usually have two kinds. There's the binary expressions that usually have some kind of operator that determines what binary expression we are looking at. These operators can be interpreted in terms of the virtual machine with instructions like add, sub, div for division, multiplication, or whatever else you might imagine to be a basic binary operator. So these all are assumed to be basic instructions of our virtual machine, and for our purposes we offer them in this form, where we have the operator or the operation in postfix form. So there's the operator on in the front, and then we have three registers associated with that, RI being target register and RJ and RK being the argument registers. So yeah, that's how it goes. why do we want it in that form? Well, you see that this is quite suitable in the following example. So usually in the source code, you will encounter a binary expression in this form where you have sub-expression E1 and sub-expression E2, and they are occurring with in infix notation with the operator in between. And, well, the code generation that we use for that would be to map the operator in the high-level language to the according instruction on the virtual machine. And, well, the target register where we communicate the result to our parent expression, for example, is given to us in form of this free register counter. So this determines the index used here for the target register. The question is now, how do we access the values of our children? Well, for that, we need to, for this E1, for example, we need to somehow trigger code generation for code that evaluates E1. This is done with a recursive call to the code generation. So far, since this is a thing that we need to do first, we haven't allocated any new register, so we can communicate that the first free register is still I. And what we want to have is code generation for E1. So this is what we write here, and what is returned is the actual code that will evaluate E1. So in order to evaluate the whole expression, we still need the second argument, E2, and therefore we trigger another code generation. But now we have to keep in mind that we still need to, at some point, access the intermediate result for the evaluation of E1. This we have stored in register RI, so register RI is now considered to be already in use. So, in order to have some well-known place for the result of the evaluation of E2, we just choose the next index that is still available, which would be register RI plus 1. So we start the code generation with RI plus 1 and do the code generation for expression E2. This leaves the machine in a state where we have intermediate results in RI and RI plus 1. So we still need to complete the last line that does the actual operator instruction. And, well, it still needs to refer to the intermediate results from before. So this is where we now refer to variables RI that was filled by the first code generation call, and the RI plus 1 was filled by this one. So there we can find the intermediate results in RI and RI plus 1. And well, since after execution of this operation, we don't need the intermediate results of the former expressions anymore, we can just reuse this RI to be the new target register and use that to communicate back to the parent expression. So this is the general technique that we use for evaluating our expressions. An example. Let's say we want to generate code for the expression 3 times 4. Then we, at some point, get a call to the code generation function, and this comes with a few registers being already in use. May it be local variables, may it be other intermediate results that have been computed before, we don't know, and we also don't care because we won't touch them. Instead, the fourth register is the first one available to us. So according to the scheme from above, we can use this slot in order to provide the first intermediate result. So this is code 4, R of 3. And the second parameter will be code 5, because in these binary expressions, we then have to increment our intermediate counter for the second argument. So code 5, R of 4. And then we do the actual binary expression code generation with the multiplication instruction and using the intermediate results from R4 and R5 to come up with the new intermediate result stored in R5 to be used in whatever context this 3 times 4 has been used. And I think this goes even on in calling code R43 and code R44, and this will replace thing according to our translation schemes with load C operations for constants. And we had the code generation for 4 and 5, so we see that they go into registers 4 and 5. And this is the way that the code generation actually really works with concrete numbers for the free register counter. Okay. So these free or the temporary registers that we use throughout that we have seen that they are somehow reused a little bit on the level of reuse the one of the temporary registers for taking the actual result value of the current sub-expression. But you have to keep in mind that this reusage is not even just happening within one instruction, but also the usage of these registers interleaves with each other when there are more complicated expressions. So for that, we can, for example, look at the expression from over here, where we have 3 times 4 plus 3 times 4, starting at some register 4. So what that will mean is that we will trigger the generation of code for the two sub-expression of the children from this parent expression, which is this 3 times 4, and they will be parameterized with the first free variable being 4 and 5. I think I used wrong color. So 4 and 5. So, and they get then connected to each other with this add of 4 and 5 targeting 4. We have seen that the code generation pattern for 3 times 4 is also a quite simple one. We have just done it with a concrete number, but now let's have a look at how that works for a variable. So this would usually have the pattern that you see here, where the first load C goes directly into RI, the second load C goes into RI plus 1, and then they are connected so that they work on RI and RI plus 1. So in the context of the larger expression now, this I is now instantiated with 4 and 5, which leads to the pattern then being instantiated with 4 and 5, creating load C of 4, which is in that sense a unique usage of R4 so far at least. The second loads its instruction to R5, in order to provide a value for the R4. So there's the first reusage of a variable. This is the one that stems from just a local binary expression interpretation. But now, if we continue with the second code generation for 3 times 4, we will see that there's another load C that again refers to R5. So this is the same R5 as the one that we have had here. So this is reused here again. So there's even some overlap between in principle independent expressions. And yeah, this is followed by a load C to R6, which is fresh so far. And then we reuse R5 again, but this is coming from the local expression evaluation. And then we continue with the parent expression, which then accesses R4 and R5 and again writes to R4. So there's a lot of sharing of variables going on in that sense. It's, well, each of these sub-expressions comes with a kind of a window of the registers that it uses, and these windows are in when there's another sibling that also uses registers, those are just offsetted by one cell each time that they are used, so there's quite a potential for overlap in that sense. But since for each of these expressions, we only ever expect one memory cell in terms of a register being communicated as the intermediate result and nothing more. This is perfectly fine, since this intermediate result can survive in this single register, and we can overwrite the values that we have used before. So that is fine. So all in all, in terms of semantics of the operators that we use, there's an overview right here. And I think this is not too surprising. This is just how the arithmetic is, considered to be working. Well, it's integer arithmetic, so this is a thing that you might want to add there. For our concepts here, integers are, well, just like natural or, well, integer numbers, and don't have any particular properties like concrete integers have, like wrap around after a particular high number is reached, for example. So this is kind of generic unbounded integer numbers that we have here. Also, we don't only have the usual arithmetic operators like the ones from up here, but we also have comparators, which is binary operators for comparisons on integers, which would be those, for example. And, well, then there's also like the bit operators that we see down there. So this is considered to be kind of smallest units out there that do some computation, and we can just map the sub-expressions that we find in the original language to these kind of instructions. So, yeah. There's also the other kind of operators, which is the unary operators. They are, well, not so many. There's usually the negation, like this minus operator, or the logical negation, like the not operator. And, well, they are just coming with one parameter, so our code generation just has to evaluate one sub-expression and then perform the operator with two instead of three registers, and that's that. So for that, we use the same register. I think in a few concrete machine architectures that are out there, you will have a lot of instruction sets that don't actually really accept
three registers, but only two, and will already implicitly reuse the first parameter as the target register also, but for our purposes, we keep them apart. So, of course, an example for unary operator, -4, would be translated, well, like generating the code for 4 and then doing the actual negation on the register R5, and yeah, for 4 itself, we also need a load C. So this is what -4 gets translated into. Yeah, this is the semantics of the operators. I think there's nothing too surprising in there. Good. So, now that we have had some basic expression interpretation, what we are actually really would like to go for is to come to a state where we can start translating like blocks, like bodies of functions, for example. And what we usually get out of something like that is that in such a block, we usually have the concept of a few variables that are declared for function's body as local variables. So these fellows over here. And these are the ones that actually contribute to the environment of expression evaluation by initializing the mapping row with a few values, like this x is the first local variable, so x goes into the first local register, y is the second local variable, so y goes into the second one, z is the third one, so z is mapped to the third local register. So this is how function bodies usually start. You register each of the variables in that scope in the address environment, and in that sense the first three registers are already given away. So R4 is the lowest indexed register that can still be used. So, well, our counter of first three variables would start from 4 without even having seen any evaluation expression so far, just from reserving space for local variables. So in order to now translate things like these, well, expression statements, it is here in that case, but this incorporates evaluating an expression like this one here, we will have to start the code generation for that one with the lowest free register index. So the code generation for that thing would start with 4 as the initial value, and this is then communicated down to the actual right-hand side value code generation for y plus z plus 3, and then continued according to whatever specified here, like the assignment here. So I think this continues now with the next few steps, like giving code generation schemes for this y plus z plus 3. This consists in the predominant thing here. This would be the y value. So y is stored at register 2. So we insert a move from register that is associated with y, being R2, into the first free variable, first free register, which is 4. So this is the first thing that needs to be done here. Then there is the second operand for the sum here, which is set times 3. This now has to go into register R5 in terms of its intermediate result. And apart from that, we just do plain code generation for set times 3. And then afterwards, we come up with the result with this add operation over here. So now we still have to say how this one works now, and this is given by this one here. This now refers to variable z, which is stored at index 3. So we do a move from R3 to the next free register that we, whose index we get told by the index of the code generation function. So we move R3 to R5. We still need the code generation for 3 in now the next free variable, which is 6, which will just move 3 into 6. So all in all, what we get for the whole assignment is this nice instruction, this nice instruction sequence down there. So it's a modular thing. We start from the complete instruction, call the code generation for each of the operands, and complete the code generation for each of the sub-expressions by appending the line that deals with the current expression's interpretation. And, well, in that sense, this is a thing that can be done with these attribute things, just introducing a code attribute and evaluate that in a synthetic way. Okay, so maybe a quick peek into what statements and control structures are all about before we are done for today. So, statements and expressions. What we have seen so far is just generating code for expressions. Therefore, we have looked at this code generation for expressions right-hand sides with code RI of an expression E. And this is enough for certain parts of the syntax tree that deal with expressions. But at some point in the C grammar, we these expressions are anchored into statements. Usually they are in assignment statements, for example. These are just expressions that are terminated with a semicolon, or they might be found in conditions or parameters for function calls, for example. So these are the usual suspects where expressions are anchored into other components of the syntax tree. So for our purpose, the first point where such an expression is anchored into some context is this expression statement. So this is just an expression. Usually the predominant one to use there is the assignment expression. And this is then anchored into a statement by appending a semicolon. And together with a semicolon, this is then an expression statement. So this is the point where we switch from general code generation with just code of some this was not the right binding. Code generation without any indices on this expression statement. We then switch over to code generation for right-hand side expressions of the E1 to E2 thing. And usually this code generation for right-hand side expressions provides its intermediate result in the temporary register RI that this code generation is initialized with. But for expression statements, this intermediate or temporary result then is not of any interest anymore. And in that sense, will be overwritten at the next opportunity. So yeah, that's usually that. Okay, so this is our bridge to statements. What other statements are there usually to be found? Well, statements can occur in sequences. So there's usually lists of statements with S being a single statement and this double S being another list. So we step by step deconstruct these lists into code generation for single statements and other lists, where there is also the code generation for the empty list, which is just nothing. So there, with that, we just say that, well, statement sequences are just resulting in sequences of instructions, each of them provided by the code generation of each statement separately. So they just concatenated to each other. Now, the other statements that are around there are usually ones that create deviating control flow. In order to do so, we said that we would have to leave the concept of just falling through to the next instruction, but we somehow need to manipulate the control flow, particularly the way that the interpretation loop fetches the next instruction from the code store. So this is a thing that these architectures usually do within a jump instruction. So the semantics of the jump instruction is usually that you give some kind of reference to wherever you want the control flow to go to in your sequence of instructions in form of some kind of abstract label or concrete address that in terms of compiler construction you would usually start with if you're coming from source, go down to target code. Well, you would first start with some kind of abstract concept of addresses in terms of some kind of identifiers or labels for code positions, which would then in the subsequent phase be translated into actual real addresses. So for our purposes, we remain on the level of having labels for specifying where the control flow would have to go to. So, but in principle, this is just addresses. This can be simply replaced in the next phase of the compilation. So, what a jump then does, it is parameterized with a label that gives us an address, and what's done is essentially that the program counter is set to the address that is given, and that is kind of all that there is. There's also more complicated things like the conditional jumps, which would take two parameters. So this is the so-called jump zero here, which would jump depending on the value found in the register that is specified as parameter. So the jump C jumps for RIA would have two behaviors depending on the evaluation of the value that is stored in RI. If RI is different from zero, for example, well, nothing would happen. The value that was found in PC survives the execution of the thing and will be used as the next continuation address. This just says that in that case we would just continue with the instruction that we reached by falling through the jump C. Then there's the situation where the register RI actually has an entry that is equal to zero, and in that situation, the value of the program counter now actually changes. So this is not the same anymore. Instead, the labeled address from there makes it into the program counter, thus determines that the next fetched instruction will come from that address instead of the fall through. So that's that. So these are the tools that we have in order to represent the control flow structures from statements part. So let's have a look at what we can do with that. So the next few statements that are interesting is maybe the branching statement for the if statement, for example. So the if statement consists of some conditional expression and a statement that is executed in case that the condition evaluates to a certain value. Particularly, it's of interest whether the condition evaluates to zero or not. And why is that? Well, this is because architectures usually have some kind of instruction like this jump depending on a value being zero or not. So, in that sense, the code generation for this S being the if statement would consist of first generating code that evaluates the conditional expression found in the specification of C by calling the code generation for C with I being the first free register. So the condition's value is computed and saved in register RI. Then we complement that with an actual instruction, this jump Z thing that is jumping depending on the value of this RI, reaching some label A that is conveniently placed at the end of the instruction sequence that we are looking at. And as fall through behavior, we see the code that corresponds to whatever is given to us in this following statement SS here. And well, we just call the code generation for this SF thing. And yeah, that's that. The only thing that you have to keep in mind is that, of course, applying this pattern means that for each application of this pattern, we of course need to provide a fresh label instance. So in case that we have several if statements, of course we won't reuse the label A again for the next conditional statement. Instead, we will just have an A prime, or just number them as A1, A2, A whatever. So they only need to be consistent within this particular sub-expression. Okay, we can then generalize this to the little bit more complicated version of the if branch that carries an else statement with it in this double E thing, and this just introduces one addition to the whole thing. So the evaluation of the conditional expression remains the same. Also, the code generation for the true branch is remaining the same. The only thing is that now at the position where the jump instruction branches to, we now don't continue with the execution of the program, but instead we find that there is another statement code found that corresponds to the else branch. So this is what we find here. And in order for the true branch not to run into the else branch, we need to complement this with another static jump instruction, jump B, that jumps to the end of the complete construct. So yeah, the black and the red parts are in that sense, the ones that are added in comparison to the conditional branch before. Okay? And again, this A, B things are fresh variables just for that particular code generation thing. So with that, we are already quite close to... Oh, well, there's an example here, so let's maybe have a look at the example. So this is now a concrete instance of a conditional statement. So this comes in the context of the address environment being X mapping to 4 and Y mapping to 7 and a few other registers maybe being used in between that are not really referred to in this example thing. So what will come from this thing is the following scheme. So we will have to do the part here where we do evaluate the conditional expression. So this is a greater than comparator on two parameters coming from RI and RI plus 1. So the two parameters here are X and Y stored at 4 and 7. So we obtain them from their respective locations 4 and 7 and store their value into what is given with RI and RI plus 1. Use them over here to provide the result in RI, and this is then used in the jump 0, which will determine whether we enter the true branch or not. So yeah, the true branch then is the subtraction from over there. So this is this this expression statement, and this expression statement consists of an assignment. So has this X being set with something specific here, like this move. So this moves into R4 because X is associated with 4. The parameter of that thing is the result of the right-hand side of the assignment. So this is given by the previous things here, that is determined by this subtraction. So this subtracts the two operand variables, ri and ri plus 1, and stores the result in ri to be saved into x. And they are loaded from their respective variable things. And after that, we exit the whole thing with label B. And in a similar fashion, we have another subtraction over here that will be translated in a quite similar thing like this. And, well, this is the else branch that is reached with the label A from over here that drives us here. And then we fall through into the same place where also the jump from the true branch went to. Okay, so this is kind of basic expression translation and basic control statements. Now for anything more complex than that, like loops and function calls, I think we're gonna continue next time. So thank you for your attention and see you next week. Okay.